Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals, and I love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. My Fulbright series, Voices of Uganda, continues this week with Mandela Washington Fellow, business owner, and entrepreneur, Gerard Iga. Last week, I talked with the chief warden of Bwindi Mogahinga Conservation Area, Nelson Guma. And one of the things that emerged from that conversation was the growing relevance of tourism to conservation in Uganda. One thing that many people may not recognize about Uganda is its diversity of natural spaces, wildlife, and culture. Perhaps that's why it's called the Pearl of Africa. This week's guest specializes in giving visitors a rich and diverse experience of Uganda, sharing his love of his country with others. Gerard Iga is passionate about tourism and community development. He's the owner of Lotto Tours, connecting natural resources and cultural resources with conservation, all while uplifting communities. Now, we did have a few sound issues in this episode with people talking in the background, so apologies for that. All right, let's get to it. I'm really excited to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Glad to be here.
So, you know, recently CNN just named Bwindi one of the top picks to visit or on the bucket list or whatever list it was. And I think that, you know, I've been here in Uganda for 6 months and I'm meeting a lot of people who are just discovering how amazing Uganda is. And before we talk in, you know, start talking about tourism, really specifically, I always like for my listeners to learn a little bit about my guests. So can you share with us some of your background, where you're from?
Where I am from? That's a long story. Do you have all day?
We have as much time as you want.
Well, anyway, I am from the northwestern part of Uganda, in a town called Arua. My parents were from this part of the country, but they moved for work to Kampala, the capital, which is more towards the south of the country. And that is where I spent most of my life growing up, school, all the way through to university. I spent most of that time in Kampala. I'd only visit the northwestern part of the country for Christmas holidays or long school holidays. So then that's when I got to spend some time here. So I did spend 1 year of school here, and I really loved it. That's probably why I came back. I spent most of my life growing up in Kampala, and basically, most of my life was in Kampala, but the last 10 years I have spent here. I moved here in 2012, February 2012. So that's about 11 years now that I have spent in the northwestern part of Uganda.
But that's interesting. And, you know, I've not actually been to that part of Uganda yet. So this is really curious for me. You've spent most of your life growing up in the city, and yet your professional trajectory has now brought you to the point of, you know, tourism, not just for conservation of natural resources, but, you know, as we know from your intro, cultural resources as well. And so I'm curious, how, when you were growing up, did you always feel a connection to nature? Did you always like, you know, animals or wildlife, or what, how did you connect with the natural world around you?
I think for me, I've always had a love for the outdoors. From when I was a very little boy, I was that kid who would leave home early in the morning, disappear for the whole day and come back in the evening and get spanked for it.
Hey, I think we have something in common.
So I'd spend the whole day adventuring all over the neighborhood. We didn't grow up very far away from Lake Victoria, which is the biggest lake in Africa, as you know.
I do.
So we didn't live very far away from the shore. Sometimes we went out to the swamps in the lake to fish or to get papyrus for making some crafts materials, or get clay for making our own toys and stuff like that. So for me, basically doing outdoor stuff or just adventuring and discovering the world around me, it's always been something that interests me.
That's wonderful. It's so funny because I distinctly remember I was about 8 years old and I just, you know, I thought I asked permission. I just was like, can I go out? I thought I had a yes. So I went and I got lost. Because still to this day, my sense of direction is quite poor. So, I got lost and it was many, many hours, and, an older kid in the neighborhood, you know, guided me home, taking pity on me as I was crying. And I most definitively got spanked for that. And I was so confused. I'm like, but I asked if I could go. So I was like that too. Just I'd leave the house and just go and come back later and always get in trouble. Now, what's really fascinating to me is the diversity of your background as well, because now you run a tour company. We're going to talk about that. But you got your Bachelor's of Science in Education from Makerere, and you were a high school teacher.
Yes, I was.
Now, I'm telling you, like, hat off to you. I teach university students. I don't think I could handle high school students. So what subjects did you teach, and what made you want to become a high school teacher?
That's another story altogether.
This is what we're here for, is the stories.
The school that I went to in Kampala, because when you're applying to go to university, you apply for certain courses to be considered for a government scholarship. So if you make the required points, and then you can qualify for those courses and then be taken on the government scholarship. And so the school that I went to set it as a rule that every one of us had to set education as our third choice. I ended up getting education, even though it wasn't really what I wanted.
What did you want to pursue? What was your, like,
My interest had always been in either IT or telecom engineering, or stuff like that. But though looking back now, I'm like, maybe I could have left that too. Maybe I'd have gone through that and then ended up here. So I don't know.
Go. Okay. So you had to do education.
Yeah. So basically if you get the scholarship, you can, if your parents can afford it, they can choose to still get you, pay for you to go through the course you want, or you just go through the government scholarship. I mean, the main point is getting the qualifications, getting the education. So
sure.
My parents were like, you got that, go ahead, go do it.
And okay.
Even while I was getting into the course, I knew that I wouldn't stay long as a teacher.
So let's just have a brief sidebar on the experience of teaching high school students. What was that like? First of all, what subjects did you teach?
I was teaching mathematics and economics.
Okay.
So with our system, when you go to the university, you have two teaching subjects that you study at the university. So you'll have two of them. And so for me, it was mathematics and economics.
Okay.
Even though I was doing the education course, I was an economics major.
Oh.
I was teaching mathematics, economics, and commerce for the lower classes.
Okay. Those are hard topics, actually.
Not really.
Oh, okay. never mind. Moving on. Okay, fair enough. I've just revealed something about myself. So how long were you a high school teacher? And what was the best and the not so best part of that experience? What did you learn from that experience maybe that you've taken forward with you?
I think, first of all, going through the school of education, it's very intense. Most other programs will have maybe 4, 5, 6 courses a semester. But for education, you're having maybe 10, 11 a semester. So it's a very loaded program. You are busy pretty much all the time. Part of the experience I loved was going through, because when you're in your second and third year, you have to go through what they call school practice, where you actually go out there and start to learn.
Yeah.
To be a teacher in classes, and then you'll have assessors coming through. So, I mean, that helped me to improve on my confidence speaking in public, speaking before people, handling a class, dealing with these young people, and so on. So those are skills that even now are still useful to me. And I taught for 3 years after finishing school. It was a great experience, actually. I loved interacting with the students. Of course, they say teenagers are usually a difficult bunch to handle. But I believe it's about how you interact with them. Say, if you treat them like children, then they're going to behave like children. But if you treat them, if you give them the respect, then they will respect you in time. And so it makes it easier for both of you to, if you set some standards, okay, this is what we expect of each other. Let's all hold up to our end of the deal.
Yeah.
Then it works out so much easier.
Yeah, like one of the things I used to do in some of my classes is at the beginning of the semester, first day, like, hey, let's make a list of expectations. Like, what are you actually expecting from the class, from me? And what do you think I'm expecting of you? Like, I make them tell me what they think my expectations are.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and in those times where I've done that, sometimes that's helpful and sometimes, you know, it's not. Okay, so now I'm curious because, you know, I was really interested that you were a Mandela Washington Fellow. I just recently interviewed another Mandela Washington Fellow who is, his focus was on climate change policy. And and so I'm really interested to know what the focus of your fellowship was and why you pursued that opportunity. Like, what was appealing to you about the Mandela Washington Fellowship?
Oh, well, actually, from about 2014, a friend of mine had been to the fellowship before me, and she had been pushing me to apply for it since then. And I kept saying, I will. I applied for it when I was still a teacher in 2015, but I didn't get it that time. Until 2018, and this time I was successful and managed to go for it. And so the Mandela Washington Fellowship has 3 different tracks. You can either go under civic management, leadership in business, or leadership in public management. So for me, it was leadership in business.
Okay.
And so I was at the University of Iowa. That was a great experience, learning from the different teachers that we had at the faculty. And of course, the networking opportunities we had, the field visits to different businesses and organizations doing so many amazing things. Interacting with the volunteers in the community, volunteering, doing some work with some organizations doing some amazing work in their community. So the whole experience was really eye-opening.
So your friend was on to something, and I'm wondering, did you already leave teaching when you left teaching, and then you did get it in 2018? Had you started your business yet?
Yes, I started my business right after I left teaching. So I had set a target for myself in 2010 that I would, because 2010 is when I decided that I was going to go into business. And so, but by then I had no idea about, how to run a business, how to start a business. I was like, let me give myself 5 years to learn. Mm-hmm. And then after those 5 years, I'll go into business.
Okay.
Whether I'm ready or not.
Sometimes so, that's the way it has to be, right? When you're pursuing your dreams.
So 2015 was when my 5 years were up and I knew. I had to leave the job and jump right in.
Okay. And how did the leadership and business fellowship opportunity enrich, did it change anything about the way you were doing your work and your business?
Of course, when you're starting out in business, especially like a person like me, in the northwestern part of the country where there's not so much infrastructure in terms of supporting startups. Actually, we'll probably talk about that. I'm trying to start something in that line for young people in my town. You're sort of figuring everything out on your own, and yet there are resources out there that you do not know of, already people have, streamlined ways which could make things much easier for you. And so those are some of the things I learned during the fellowship, customer discovery methodology and stuff like that, that really helps you as a startup to figure out a lot of things before you waste money, but things that you can just do very quickly to make sure that you're on the right track. That really was very helpful.
Well, let's start talking about your business. You are in the tourism industry. And what appealed to you about that? Like, what made you decide tourism was the business you wanted to get into? And do you specialize in any particular locations?
I actually kind of just stumbled into this thing.
Of course you did.
So when I moved to Arua, because I had spent so much time growing up in Kampala, I was very curious about the region. I wanted to know, what was there to see around the region. And at that time, a cousin of mine and I had started a website. By then, it was called arua.today.com. Eventually, it became insidewestnile.com, more of an information website region. And so my interest was to travel around and get to know about what the region had to offer in terms of tourism, in terms of business, what opportunities were out there, what natural, what historical attractions were there. So for me, it was more of curiosity that led me out there to discover places that were already there, but were not getting the attention that they should, because maybe to the local people, they were just normal or they didn't see anything spectacular about them. So I started to post about these places on Facebook. And one of the tour operators who lives in Kampala was a contact on Facebook, and he kept seeing my posts and he said, "Hey, Gerard, I see you visiting all these places in West Nile and posting about them. Why don't you consider starting to do trips, to bring people out to see some of these places? They're really interesting." Of course, that was maybe about 2013, but by then I was not yet sure that's like the direction I wanted to go. I wasn't really thinking of going into the tourism business, but and so it took me a while to come around. So in November of 2013, an eclipse happened, and one of the best places to see it was here in Uganda. and actually right here in West Nile.
Oh, wow.
A town called Bakwach. So when I visited this gentleman at his office in March of that year, I was like, oh, Gerard, there's this eclipse coming up and there's people coming from all over the world. Why don't you organize for a group from Kampala to come see it? That was my first tour trip, November 2018.
And what was that experience like?
Tragic.
Oh, no. It was tragic. Okay, wait. Tragic.
It was a disaster.
Did somebody die or not that kind
no,
of
tragic? No.
Okay. Okay. Not that kind of level of tragic. Epic fail is what we would say. It was an epic fail.
It was terrible.
Oh, no. What happened?
There's a lot we didn't organize, right? The transport was disorganized. Our itinerary was all over the place. And so, you know, doing things the first time, you're just basically figuring it out as you go. I feel pity for the guys who came for our first trip. Oh. We had about 11 people.
Oh, no, there was 11 tragic experiences. Yeah.
And the lady that recommended me for the fellowship was actually one of those people. I met her through that trip.
Well, but then it can't have been that bad if she recommended.
Yeah. She understood that we're just learning and trying. So
of course
she kept encouraging.
That's great. That's wonderful. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of things didn't go well. And yet you persisted. Did something about that experience, even with it not going well, inspire you to do it again?
Yes. And so from then I started to organize, that was 2013. I started to organize hiking trips to one of the hills, a mountain a bit closer to Arua, the town where I live, maybe 30 kilometers out. So I started to organize trips to that every December. That because I was still teaching, I couldn't yet go into it full time. So I would organize regular trips. Started with the hiking by then. And then 2015, at the end of 2015, I quit the teaching and got fully into the tourism side of things. And so 2016 started to get into more things, adding on the culture aspect, going to town tours and now do our rural city tours.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. So we've kept on adding to what we're going to do. Of course, apart from that, we've been also doing the visits to the national park. The nearest to us is Murchison Falls National Park. It's about 2 hours out.
Okay.
So we do visits there too.
Okay. And when you talk about the cultural experience, can you share a little bit about, I mean, I know that Uganda has many, many tribes. So where I am, it's the Muchiga.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what is the dominant or most represent? I don't know if there's many tribes in that northwestern part too. I don't mean to be so ignorant, but what is the culture there and the tribes there that you encourage tourists to visit and experience?
Well, West Nile, the only region of Uganda with an English name, simply because it is a region that has many different ethnic groups. So they couldn't find one name that could encompass all of them in the local language.
Okay.
The main one in Arua City where I live are the Lubara. The others are Kakwa, Alul, Kebu, Mari. Which others did I miss? Jonam. Kakwa, Alur, Lubara, Ali. We also have the Nubians.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a mix of many different cultures.
It's just because I think it's interesting. Do all the tribes get along with each other in that region? And have they always?
Yeah, I think generally West Nile tribes or ethnic groups have lived in harmony for most of the history, there being maybe small time intertribal clan clashes, but it's never really been like protracted.
Okay. And what is if we were to go on a tour with you to have a cultural experience, what would that look like?
So for some, we are still developing. For now, what we are already doing is on the Arua City tour, we take you to some of the historical sites around the town, both the religious history and the cultural history. We take you to a museum, a local community museum. We do not yet have a government-run museum, so we have a small collection. There's a couple of them all over the West Nile. There's one here in Arua, there's one in Moyo, more to the north, and one towards the south, towards Panyimur. So all these give information about the ethnic groups in those areas where they are located. Some of the other aspects that we're still working on or getting into is giving people homestay experiences in the communities where they can, you know, get to understand and lead the life of the local person, what is their perspective to life, how do they go about their everyday. It's totally, of course, be a totally like for me when I went to the US, life was totally different there.
Yeah.
For someone to come there and live in a village in Arua, it would be something totally different from the experience that they're used to, you know. So a different perspective to life, which someone can still learn from and enjoy. And so maybe you come and learn how to make some of the local foods, how to make some of the local crafts, how to build a local house, you know.
Yeah.
We get our water from the well. It doesn't come flowing through a tap.
Yep.
And so forth. So just that raw experience of what the typical, you know, village person's life is like.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's such a really, I think people, the more exposed you are to different places, different cultures, different perspectives, different ways of making a living, whether it's just as simple of how to get food and water, you know, I always feel like it can bring us all closer together because you start to, you know, live the experience of another person. And I also tend to think this extends to other animals. It's why when I sit and I watch other animals, you get to really understand what they have to do every single day to, you know, get through the day and have their needs met. And then there's the social drama that always happens. And so what you realize over time is we're not all so different. And, you know, for me, I'm fascinated and want to learn, you know, I tried learning how to weave. I really want to learn how to make bricks. I had no idea.
That should be pretty simple. Come on.
I know, but there's not that opportunity where I am. There isn't something set up, right, where you can go. Mostly I just go and I, you know, try to learn how to do something. And sometimes they're like, really? You really want to learn this? And yes, I do. And, you know, I've gotten very familiar with the local food in this region. The food changes as you move around Uganda. So wanting people to understand like just the food that's where I am doesn't mean that's the food, you know, where you are. And so I think that this opportunity appeals to a certain, you know, type of person who's curious and interested and wants to really connect. And so I love that you are offering that. You also have been developing something called voluntourism. And I'd really love to hear a little bit more about that and what your plans are for that.
So that's the conversation that started actually when I was in the US in 2019. I met a couple of people here and there who were interested in bringing high school students and college students come to volunteer stints here. And of course, while they're here volunteering, either in a project or something, they can also get an experience of the culture, living in the home. So mixing the two things, getting to experience the local culture while also doing something that is helpful for the community. Of course, COVID came through and a lot of the plans that we had fell through.
Sure.
But looking to restart those conversations and get that moving again.
You know, I see this in many places where it's like you don't just have to come and be a tourist. You can come and do service, you know, while you are visiting somewhere. So I think it's such a great idea, and I think that it can do a lot of, and it can make people feel useful and helpful, even when they're, you know, taking their vacation. And so, when you do tours, do you only concentrate in that area, in that region, or do you come all over Uganda?
Of course not. Why we decided to concentrate in West Nile specifically is generally because of the civil strife that was in the northern part of Uganda for many years. I'm sure you've heard of Joseph Kony.
Mm-hmm.
Most of northern Uganda was considered a no-go zone,
yeah,
or the no-go area. So for many, many years, it was that part of the country that hadn't received any visitors. So actually, the website that my cousin and I started, what we were trying to do, because even though the war stopped maybe about the early 2000s, the perception of insecurity persisted. So our website was more to change that mindset, show what good things are in the northern part of Uganda. And eventually, of course, now ended up in tourism and realizing the potential that it has for helping the communities. Like, okay, even for tourism, this region has not been considered as a place that someone can visit. What can we do around?
Yeah.
What can we create that would make people interested in coming to visit?
Okay.
So most of our effort has been put into West Nile, though we do tours to other parts of the country.
Okay. Well, I know I'm going to have to be calling you to visit that part eventually. And, you know, before we shift to talk a little bit about the startup that you mentioned a little bit earlier, I just wanted to kind of get your take on, you know, tourism and tourists. So do you find that people in the West Nile region are happy to have tourists come? And, you know, what do you think is important for tourists to, you know, what do you want them to know and appreciate? And people who might be listening, you know, who might not think of ever coming to Uganda, like to have them know and appreciate about Uganda that can bring them to come here.
Wow.
I know, it's a big question.
Where do I start? There's so much. Well, you've been here, you know.
I know.
Uganda, our weather, our food, the people being so friendly and welcoming, the many cultures, the big attraction, the gorillas.
I know.
The mountains. So Uganda is pretty much has everything that you would want to see.
Yeah.
Specifically for West Nile, named West Nile because it's the region of Uganda that's west of the Nile. Yeah, so it's it has a very, very, very long history, which is spans all the way back to the Ottoman Empire.
Wow.
We were like the southernmost tip of the Ottoman Empire, and then changed from Anglo-Egyptian Sudan to first the Congo Free State of King Leopold before eventually becoming a part of Uganda. So we've been part of the three countries, Sudan, Congo, and Uganda, and finally Uganda.
Yeah.
And over that period, many different foreign influences have acted here, from the Arab slave traders to the very first Europeans who are trying to find the source of the Nile, pass through West Nile, coming through from the north or coming from the south, heading back north. And so there's a lot of historical sites along the way. For anyone interested in outdoors activities, cycling, hiking, there's a lot of spots for that. There's really so much.
Well, so now I went right to food. So with that influence of with that deep history and all those different influences, what's some of the, you know, signature dishes that one can taste in the West Nile area?
There's a type of fish from Lake Albert that is mostly got at Kapwatch. It's the most popular, I think, fish from West Nile. It's called Nang Nang.
Nang Nang?
Nang Nang.
Nang Nang. Nang. Okay.
Yes. It's like the Ugandan sardines.
Ugandan sardines.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So a lot of people traveling through West Nile usually like to buy that. Unique thing, especially about northern foods, is we like to cook a lot of our foods in peanut gravy.
Peanut sauce?
Yes.
Yes.
So we cook a lot of our dishes, have a lot of that, but the way it is done in the south is a bit different from how it is done up here. We first fry the peanuts.
Uh-huh.
And then pound them and then put them in the sauce. Then they just pound it through and then put in the sauce.
Oh, you know, that's really smart because that releases some of the oils. Once you fry them, you're getting the oils out, and it probably brings the flavor of the peanuts more strongly. Yes. So just a side note about peanuts, peanuts. So I did not know why peanuts in the U.S. are called peanuts, and here they're called G-nuts.
G-nuts.
Yeah, and what I learned is they grow in the ground, so they're called, right? Wait, but it gets even better, because then I'm like, well, that makes sense, so how did the name peanuts come about? And it turns out that peanuts are called peanuts in the U.S. because they're related to the peas, the pea family. They're in the pea family.
Right.
And because I was trying to figure out, why are they called G-nuts when they're actually peanuts? Anyway.
Oh, yeah. So many other things that you Americans name wrongly.
Hey, wait a minute. Okay. Yeah, that we name wrongly. Okay, fair enough. Oh my gosh. I mean, well, so I want to take a tour with you. But, you know, I hope that, and I think something that you mentioned, you know, Uganda has everything, and it is called the Pearl of Africa. And, you know, and I think that what I've noticed, and I don't know if you've had this experience when you're taking tourists around, tourists are often so surprised about everything that Uganda has. They're shocked.
Because it doesn't get talked about as much.
It doesn't. And in fact, I would argue that many people don't even know there is a Uganda, right?
Right.
And so I was also surprised. I was very surprised. I mean, it literally has everything, but also the people and the food and the friendliness that came as, like, I had no concept of how people would receive, you know, someone foreigner, you know? And so that was really heartwarming for me to experience. And I hope that, you know, people will come for reasons. I mean, I love the gorillas, obviously, and they are a flagship species. And Uganda has cheetahs. They've got the big five. We've got cheetahs, you know, lions, leopards, you know, elephants, all of it. And hippos. Yeah, rhinos. And so it has everything to offer on the wildlife front. And it has so much diversity on the cultural front. And so, you know, I hope that people start to come for more than just the flagship species
Yeah. You know?
and really appreciate the diversity of what Uganda has to offer. And the other thing that I found, which takes us to your startup, you know, what you're doing in that arena as an entrepreneur, because really you're obviously an entrepreneur. There's so much creativity. There's so much innovation. There's so many good ideas that people have here about what they want to do and what they want to change and the impact that they want to have for themselves and for the future. And so what is the startup sort of platform that you were mentioning? What is that?
The Mandela Fellowship Program does a lot of support for alumni. And one of those components is called the Reciprocal Exchange, where you get to implement a project in partnership with someone that you met while you were for the fellowship.
Okay.
So while I was there, I met a guy in Iowa City who does training for startups. And so when the time came to apply for this reciprocal exchange program, I just shot him an email and said, hey, would you, consider partnering with me to come over and do a training for a few startups in my city on some of those basic concepts that, we learned while we were in Iowa, because I think that would be useful to other people here too. And he was like, sure, let's apply for it. Let's go for it. And so we did, and we were successful. And we got a $5,000 grant for that. And he was able to travel here and spend about a month in Uganda. Yeah, and we had training for about 30 startup founders in my city, and that was a very successful event, because many of them learned some basic concepts that some of them even up to now keep coming up to me and telling me what we learned there is helping my business in this way and that. So that for me is the goal to first, that for me was just the starting group. The end goal is to have a small community of entrepreneurs where we can support each other, learn from each other, encourage each other ideas, but then eventually to create all the other pillars that would help starting a business here much simpler, creating activities and events where people can come and learn, creating, the professional, whether legal or tax consultants and so forth, will be a support for the startups as they start how to give, ideas and advice at an affordable rate, of course. And then eventually bringing in on the other side, the investors, can get money for ideas to keep on going. So this project was for me just a start to get this process moving. Yeah,
that's amazing. And what I love is that you're hitting all of the pillars, I think, for that just make life better and society better. Mm-hmm. For everyone, you've got your nature conservation, you've got your cultural conservation, and now you have the uplifting the communities around you in a way that they can improve their lives and make things better. And I think that's like what an amazing person you are.
Thank you. Actually, the part I didn't say about our tours, a lot of the activities we do within communities. Say if you're around the mountains that we go to, we get guides from within the community. We train local guides in the communities to do the guiding of our visitors. If we are to go camp out there, then it's the community run campsite. So the community gets some money to be able to accommodate us, provide for us the food, perform traditional dances and stuff like that. Because then that gives them the motivation to own this and to take care of the natural resource.
So important, and community-led conservation is really where it needs to be, rather than I mean, for all the good intentions, right? Outside organizations coming in and trying to tell communities what they need to do misses the mark a lot. So I think that's another reason why people should book tours with you, because they're supporting those local communities. And I think that supporting more Ugandan owned businesses, especially in the area of tourism, is incredibly important. And, you know, that's not to disparage any European or American owned business, but, but, you know, you're also getting the real expertise and knowledge of a local business owner. So I think that always supporting local businesses, both at the country level and then at the community level, is so important. Now, I have taken up a lot of your time and I'm going to let you go soon. But first, I read in your profile that you used to host a radio show. And so your diversity of experiences that resonates with me. And I just want to, you know, find out, what was the radio show and why are you no longer on the radio?
I'll answer the last one first. Time.
Yes.
I only have 24 hours a day. So.
I feel you on this one. Okay.
And as you probably know from radio, 1 hour on radio, you need to spend at least 4 hours preparing for that 1 hour. So
it's so true.
It needs time. Yeah. So, but radio, I think my own father worked in radio for like 30 years.
Oh, wow.
So before he retired from that, I only did brief stints. I did a 1 year stint when I was in Kampala before I moved back to Arua. And then in Arua, I did work to two different radio stations on morning talk shows. And that was fun and interesting, always interacting with people and, you know, getting them started on their day, getting people calling in, give their ideas, play music, have fun, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we have that in common as well. Gerard, thank you so much for being on the show. It's really been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope I get to meet you in person sometime and explore the West Nile region.
Very welcome.
All right. And I'm going to make sure in the show notes that we have links to your website and all of the different things that you're doing so that people can connect with you and learn more about the tours that you offer and the other programs that you're doing.
Thank you.
All right. That's it for this episode. And if you want to keep up with Gerard, head to the show notes for links to his website and how to connect with him on social media. You can get there through my website, jennifervertelin.com, or through the podcast website, Wild Connection, the podcast hosted by Podbean. Of course, you can listen to Wild Connection anywhere you get your podcast, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Google, or Podbean. Now, next week, we are continuing the focus on tourism with an emphasis on birding in particular. And we're going to be talking to a local bird guide here in Windy Impenetrable Forest National Park named Apophia Asimwe. That's all for this week. And if you're enjoying the show, please give it a like and share it with your friends. Thank you for listening. And you can follow me on Twitter @RealDrJen. And you can follow the show on Twitter @WildConnection.